We have come in our study to Romans chapter 11, verse 13 and 14, dealing with the overall issue of God's larger plan, where God is doing what He's doing in relation to bringing salvation to the Gentiles and the entire church age program, according to Paul, to make Israel jealous so that they'll come into the salvation that they have been promised for centuries. And so my understanding of verses 13 and 14 is that God's larger plan is designed for the sake of Israel, not primarily for the Gentiles. And that kind of rubs some of us a little wrongly in the sense that, you mean I'm not the focus of his attention kind of thing. But when you stop and think about it, being the focus of somebody's attention is a very pleasant experience. And there's anything wrong with it as long as you don't start making that the essence of life. Because in a servant kingdom, it's not about you. It's about them. And so we exist as God's creatures designed to be of benefit to those that are around us, whether we get any benefit out of it or not. That's the idea. And that's basically what he's going to be saying in the next several verses in chapter 11, because in verse 13 he says, "But I'm speaking to you who are Gentiles. Inasmuch then as I am an apostle of Gentiles, I magnify my ministry, if somehow I might move to jealousy my fellow countrymen and save some of them. For if their rejection be the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance be but life from the dead?" So we're going to be talking this evening again about this issue of God deliberately attempting to make Israel jealous, because that's a recurring theme that comes all the way back from verse 19 of chapter 10. At the first, Moses says, "I will make you jealous by that which is not a nation, by a nation without understanding, I will anger you." So keep that in mind as we're studying this evening, that one of the results of creating jealousy is anger rather than repentance. So we'll be talking about that some. But anyway, in our study of the previous short two-verse paragraph, verses 11 and 12, we basically saw that Paul's argument is that God's shift of focus in terms of audience, most fundamentally, I mean, the shift in theology from law to grace is a big theological thing, but Paul's focus in verses 11 and 12 is a shift in terms of audience, because God shifted from focus on Israel as the audience to the Gentiles, and salvation has come to the Gentiles, and the transgression of Israel is riches for the world, and the failure of Israel is riches for the Gentiles. All of that within the context of the larger issue to make them jealous, verse 11, and to bring about this issue of their fulfillment at the end of verse 12. So his argument is that God shift in focus to a Gentile inclusion, where his main thrust is through the apostle, that he has made the apostle of the Gentiles who carried the gospel way beyond the borders of Jerusalem and Judea. He had told the 12 that they were to, well, the 11 plus the one that they then chose to replace Iscariot, that he had told them that they were to be his witnesses unto the uttermost parts of the earth, from Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and so on. But in actual terms of geography and impact and all history, it's true that Thomas went to India. We know that historically. But we don't really get a big impact from the 11 in terms of the gospel going to the uttermost parts. That's basically Paul. First missionary journey, he goes up into the Gentile areas of Asia Minor, and then on the next one he goes over into Greece and Macedonia and down into the Peloponnesus, is that what they call it? That area below the isthmus, where Corinth was right on the isthmus. And then he has his long-term dream of going all the way to Spain. And so the basic focus of this outreach to the Gentiles is focused on Paul, and the basic thrust of it is that the gospel went west, north and west. And except for Thomas, who went to India and was put to death there, The gospel didn't penetrate east or even significantly north or south. And historically, that's the way it went. It went to Europe and then across the sea into North America and created this scenario that we're so familiar with as Americans who actually were taught history when we were in school. But then there was a movement of the Spirit in South America and over in the Orient, so that some of the bigger issues now have moved there. And in recent years, there's this huge upheaval in Africa. So in terms of the outreach to the nations, there's no doubt, looking on it from our perspective 2,000 years into the shift in audience focus, that God intended to send this message to the uttermost parts and invite the non-Jewish offspring of people that weren't connected with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob into this salvation. But Paul's argument is that this shift in audience does not at all mean that his promise to Abraham to make of him a great nation is to be understood as a merely temporary plan in the history of man to produce in Israel through the man whose name was changed to Israel from Jacob. It doesn't mean that God has dropped that, because that was a plan established in promise. And when something's established on the basis of promise, then it's up to the one making the promise to make it happen. And even if things go really, really, really badly south in terms of the progression toward that end and the accomplishment of the promise, that does not mean that God is not going to fulfill it. I mean, he deliberately set this up as an illustration with Abraham and Sarah by withholding fruit from Sarah's womb until both of them were, in our terminology, ancient. Even though Abraham did live to be 175, the testimony of Romans 4 is that Sarah had never been able to conceive, and she was way past childbearing. And Abraham's body was considered dead, even though obviously it wasn't, because he married again and had more sons and daughters, I assume. But the point is, God made sure that the picture got bleaker and bleaker and bleaker and bleaker, and letting it become more bleak and so on until it got to the point where you say, well, there is absolutely no hope here. That's when he fulfills the promise. And that's exactly what happened to the nation of Israel. He set the nation up, put them in a land, had it flowing with milk and honey, gave them all this territory, let them move into houses they hadn't built and harvest crops that they hadn't planted and benefit from the vineyards and the fig trees and all that. He just put them there. And then from then on, it was just a gradual, destructive, downhill thing for 1,500 years until he sent his son into that land and those people, and they murdered him. And for all of the disintegration of that, the obvious conclusion that all legalists would make of chapter 10, as for Israel, all day long I stretch out my hands to disobedient, obstinate people. So that means God has rejected his people, doesn't it? No. And then, in verse 11 that we looked at last time, did they stumble so as to fall? No. Because you can't erase promise by rooting it in legal demand and fulfillment by obedience, or you destroy integrity. That's the testimony of all of history, is that if you root it in man's performance of God's demands, it's a no-brainer. It's not going to happen like it's anticipated. It will not. Therefore, if God makes promises that are rooted in that kind of a methodology, it will not work, and God will become a liar. But he is not a liar. Even with Abraham, according to Romans 4:13, Abraham was promised that he would be the heir of the world. Well, Abraham died, and he owned one little tiny piece of geography, the field where the cave of Machpelah was located, so he could bury Sarah. And then he was buried there, and I think Jacob was buried there, and Joseph was probably buried there, because that was the only geography that Abraham ever really owned, and he didn't get it by promise, he bought it. So the point I'm trying to make here is that Abraham died, and he did not get the fulfillment of the promise for his own experience to make of him a great nation in his earthly physical life. And the issue was that the promise had not yet been fulfilled, and Hebrews 11:13 clearly admits that. These all died not having received the promise. Well, in biblical Christianity, physical death is not the end of the story, and therefore integrity doesn't die just because a person physically dies, because the promises are still good and they're going to be fulfilled, and resurrection is going to guarantee it and underwrite it and make it happen. That's how promise is going to be fulfilled. But it'll all be miraculous because God's doing it. It's His promises. So, until this promise has been fulfilled to Abraham that he is the heir of the world, no amount of logic or theological spiritualizing can justify the notion that God's shift of focus in terms of audience means that the promise is going to be dropped. It'll be going begging forever. God's integrity is not real. That was Satan's argument in the garden. You will not die. He lied to you. It's all about this issue of whether you can trust God or not. Most people don't. And they don't think they can. Because he's a liar in their understanding of stuff. But he's not. So Paul labors in this current context to establish a critical point, and that point is that God did not only not forget his promise to Abraham, his shift of focus to the Gentiles, to the nations, was deliberately designed to bring about the ultimate fulfillment of it. He says, I'm going to send the salvation to the nations to make you jealous enough to want it yourself, and then all Israel will be saved. So, this entire church age experiment, or whatever you want to call it, it's not an experiment, but it's an experience, for 2,000 years now, has this backdrop of God's doing this to make sure the promise to Abraham of a great nation actually comes to pass. And you can't just say, well, the church is spiritual Israel, so Israel as a nation doesn't really have a future and all. That's just baloney. In fact, I wonder, the more I study this, how in the world people that study the Bible can come up with that notion that God didn't really mean this in a literal, physical way. This has all got to be understood in a spiritual sense. Because Paul is laboring to contradict that. Does this mean they fell? No. Does this mean God's rejected his people? No! How did that become yes all of a sudden? But to understand this whole process of God sending the salvation to the Gentiles so that he could make Israel jealous enough to want it themselves. To understand that, we have to understand a more basic fact, and that is God's turn to the Gentile nations was not primarily for those nations' sake. Salvation wasn't extended to the Gentiles for the sake of the Gentiles. It was extended for the sake of Israel to make them jealous, because it was given to the Gentiles. And that's a study big enough to deserve a whole series of studies on its own. But the summary is this. God's salvation motives don't set people up as the ultimate objectives of love. People, as hell testifies, are expendable. But what is not expendable is his ultimate objective, which is making life possible within a creation reality for a certain type of person, a category which is divided as far as we know into two types of persons, angelic and human, and two types of methods, performance and faith, or as we also know them, law and grace. So to make life possible for both angels and humans, God is willing to bring some within both groups of persons, angels and humans, to an expansive experience of life. And others within those same two groups are subjected to the expansive experience of death because of the impact that that experience makes on those whose end is to experience life. There is something about experiencing life that is truncated if you don't have any death in the picture anywhere. And so God, willing to make his wrath and power known, has set this up so that there are actually examples and illustrations of what the rejection of truth and love resulting in eternal death for the devil, his angels, and human beings who have followed in their train. That reality enhances the experience of life for those who decided that they, or who were brought into this life by faith and have become objects of the mercy of God and the experience of life. And as hard as that may be to swallow, that's what Romans 9 says. The whole point there is that in our context here, when we turn to verses 13 and 14 and 15, where he is saying, okay, I'm going to talk about what I'm saying as an address to you Gentiles. Because there are some problems that Gentiles may fall into if they don't understand this, because in verse 18, Paul suggests that some of these Gentiles might become arrogant toward Israel because, hey, we got it, y'all didn't. That kind of a pride that is destructive, both to the person who embraces it and the people that he affects by his embrace of it. So there's a danger in this, but we'll get to the danger later. Right now, we're going to just look at this, why he says, I'm speaking to you who are Gentiles inasmuch as I'm an apostle to Gentiles. I magnify my ministry. So I want us to talk about the logic of the context. In verse 11 of chapter 11, Paul wrote, literally, the whole first part is a question. It's not, I say then, they did not stumble as to fall, or so as to fall, did they? It's, am I saying, therefore, did they not stumble in order that they might fall? And the answer is, absolutely not. That is not what I'm saying, and that's not what happened. They did stumble, but it wasn't unto falling. And the question is, am I saying as a doctrinal statement, did they not stumble so as to fall? And the answer is, no! So I'm not saying that. But in the grammar of verse 11 is a little tricky, but the meaning is not. The absolute and emphatic denial that this is the conclusion we ought to draw insists that we see Paul setting forth a possible but totally erroneous thesis that he immediately discounts. The possible but erroneous thesis is they sinned in such a way that they brought about eternal condemnation from God by their choice, and that's what we should conclude. And Paul says that is not what we should conclude. The so-called possible thesis is that God terminated his dealings with a persistently disbelieving and argumentative people, because that's the end of chapter 10, and that's what leads into the question that is raised in verse 1 of chapter 11 and again in verse 11. It's the same question. Did their behavior cause God to say, okay, I'm done with you? And I call it a possible thesis, but it's a so-called possible thesis in that it's just so-called. It's not even a real possibility. It seems to be valid from the doctrinal and audience shifts, because Paul is a major part of that doctrinal and audience shift. He is preaching grace and not law. He's accused by the legalists of trying to destroy the temple and the law. He is preaching primarily to the Gentiles, even though he made every effort he could to preach to the Jews, but they wouldn't listen to him. And it didn't seem to matter. Every time Paul took the gospel to the Jews, and he did. He went, every town he went into, he found out there's a synagogue there. That's where he went first. Because his gospel, according to Romans 1:16, was to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Well, he tried that, but for all his intelligence and all that, Paul had this kind of a insane obsession caused by his own heart. Because he wanted Israel to be saved. He said, I'd be willing to go to hell if they would be saved as a consequence. I want my kinsmen according to the flesh to be saved. And that obsession drove him to keep on trying. It's almost going to nag him into it, you know. And invariably, as soon as he said anything about God calling him to preach this message to the Gentiles, the Jews rose up in such a murderous rage that they wanted to kill him. And you'd think after a little while he'd kind of get the idea. Look, your ministry is to the Gentiles. Forget the Jews. Let Peter worry about that. He's a
apostle to the Jews. Let him be the one that takes the message. He hadn't aggravated them nearly as much as you have. I mean, after all, he wasn't the rising star that turned into a traitor. But nonetheless, Paul is calling this that they might fall as a possible thesis, but it's totally invalid, and it seems to be something that he has wrestled with because he is preaching a grace and is preaching to the Gentiles sort of indicates that maybe God has rejected his people. He's not talking to them anymore, and he's not pouring the law out on them anymore. He's preaching grace, and they don't want to hear that, and he's sending the message to the Gentiles, and they don't want him to do that either. They don't believe the grace message, but for some reason they don't want the Gentiles to hear it. It just makes about as much sense as some of the stuff that's going on in Washington these days. But anyway, it's an impossible thesis that God has cut off his people, rejected them, because of the fundamental nature of God. We've already said this. The integrity of God is at stake. You could posit the theoretical breakdown of integrity in God, but the positing is merely a way to argue a position. It has nothing to do with actual reality. Satan declared the breakdown of the integrity of God in Genesis chapter 3, but nobody who believes buys into that. So, it's really an amazing thing that the thesis that God has terminated his dealings with Israel as a nation has become a major part of the theology of visible Christendom. There's some kind of appeal there, but for the life of me, I can't figure out why anybody buys into it. I guess I just don't have enough Reformed friends to explain it to me. Anyway, it's a totally erroneous thesis. It could not be made any clearer by Paul than to twice say, absolutely not. And in Greek, that's meganoita. So in verse 11, he's saying, am I saying? And he says, no! In verse 13, where we're supposed to actually be to see, now he says, I am saying to you who are Gentiles. So what you're concluding that I might in theory be saying is not true, but as to you Gentiles, I am saying this. And the word speaking and the word saying in verse 11 and 13 is the same word, lego. So this means that Paul is going to set forth the true antithesis. What is theoretically possible in verse 11 is revealed to be completely impossible, not only by adamant denial, but also by the greater revelation and illumination that these words bring to us when Paul in verse 13 actually starts talking directly to the Gentiles about this issue. I'm going to address you Gentiles in terms of this whole issue of God turning in message and audience away from Israel in law as a temporary pursuit of a methodology that, even though it's fraught with all kinds of problems, will be ultimately effective. What he is saying in verse 13 and 14 and following, I am saying this to you who are Gentiles. What is he saying? Well, I'm saying, for one thing, that there is a new audience, you Gentiles. There is a new audience. This is an audience that has no genealogical connection to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. If you have a genetic linkage to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you are Israel. And nobody of the Gentiles gets to be in that genealogical list. If you have the genetic linkage of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in your DNA, you're a Jew. You're an Israelite. Therefore, when he says, now I'm going to talk to you guys that don't have that connection. So, the new audience is a group of humanity that cannot trace its physical descent back to any of the 12 sons of Israel. And as a consequence, they cannot trace their theological setting or understanding back to the law of Moses, because it was given to Israel, and they're not Israel. So it's primarily for the new audience. I'm speaking to you who are Gentiles. But then he says, inasmuch then as I am an apostle to the Gentiles, that is a translation of a series of Greek words that strung together mean that what Paul is saying is, I am an apostle of Gentiles by divine appointment, and it's emphatic, this basis for Paul's doctrine. Paul established this thesis that he is an apostle of Gentiles by stringing a series of words together that basically they're these words. Upon so much indeed, therefore. Well, all that boils down to is, look, I want you to get this. This is emphatic. These words boil down to this declaration. A great deal of divine labor was expended to make me what I am as your apostle. When he says apostle of the Gentiles or your apostle, he doesn't mean that they're the origination of his apostleship. He simply means God made me apostle to you guys. That's what Romans chapter 1 says point blankly in verses 5 and 6. God appointed me apostle to the Gentiles. Well, what that means is that what he's saying is this is apostolic doctrine. And it's further established in verse 13 when he says, after he strings those words together about upon so much indeed, therefore, I am an apostle of Gentiles, he says, I am as a duplication again. It's eimi ego. It's the reverse of Jesus' I am, that's ego eimi, which means I am the I am. Well, in Paul's case, he switches that. He says, I am, that is, I. And it's just emphatic. I am an apostle of Gentiles. And what I'm doing here is I'm magnifying my ministry. So it's rooted in the fact that Paul is now God's spokesman for the nations, for their sake, for their salvation. Let's cut at what he says in verse 14 at the end. To save. To save. I am this apostle for salvation. In your case, as Gentiles, you're given the opportunity of salvation. But I'm even making that available to you in harmony with God's plan to save some of Israel by making them jealous. But it's emphasizing this thing that's translated my ministry. That word is actually a word that comes, it's a noun that gives us the word deacon in the scriptures. A deaconate, it means a position of responsible task. So in terms of a ministry, this is, Paul calls it a stewardship wherein man must be found faithful. He has been given this job, this position as a deacon, as an apostle to Gentiles. That's his required, declared task. And given that, he has to be found faithful so that he can say, I have to preach because if I don't, woe be to me. That's what he told the Corinthians. If I do it willingly, I have a reward. But if I don't do it willingly, woe be to me if I don't do it. In other words, this is my stewardship and I have to fulfill it. It's emphasizing that. He's been given a charge by God. And he says, I am exalting this. I am magnifying it. The word is actually doxazo. It means I'm glorifying it. But all that means is he's exalting his status as God's appointed apostle to the nations. And that leads to verse 14 where he explains his motive. Why is he turning to the Gentiles, exalting his apostleship from God to Gentiles, and then magnifying that? It's kind of like rubbing salt in the Jews' wound, because Paul has already so irritated them that his relationship with them is an open wound to them. They hate him. And he is just exalting his ministry to the Gentiles, and it's almost like it's, you know, rubbing salt in that. And he says, I'm doing it on purpose. Why? So I might move them to jealousy somehow. I want to make them jealous. That is my fellow countrymen. The Jews, Israel. As an explanation of motive, he uses the verb, translated by the New American Standard, as move to jealousy. But he first used that verb in Romans in chapter 10, verse 19, when he quoted Moses, when he claimed that it was God's stated declaration from the beginning in Deuteronomy 32:21 that someday he would provoke Israel to jealousy by a people that were not a nation and by a nation that was not a nation. He's going to use the Gentiles, a people that were not his people, he's going to do that to provoke them to jealousy. But in that same context, Deuteronomy, which I referred to as we started out, it also says, I'm going to make you angry. And we all know that that's one of the first things that happens with jealousy. Hot anger. In fact, I think we told you last time about a situation of jealousy where a guy comes home to a woman that he thinks is loyal to him and finds her with another man. And so he shoots and kills the other man and shoots her in the face and burns her house down and does this in front of two of her four kids. Now what caused that? Jealousy. Paul, are you nuts? Why are you doing? Why are you rubbing this salt in their wound just to make them jealous? Don't you know that that's going to make them even angrier with you? He said, don't ask me that. I already got the stripes and the bruises and the bumps and the thumps. Sure, I know that. But why does he do it then? Well, partly because he has bought into God's declared intention. He hasn't adopted this as his own motive. He isn't saying, I'm getting even with them for the way they treat me so bad. I'm exalting my commission by God to the nations just to rub it in their face or rub their face in it. No, he is basically saying, look, God's the one that dreamed this method up, Deuteronomy 32. I'm just following his lead. So in that sense, we can see that Paul's motivation and his wisdom is not his. It's God's. But jealousy typically has an approach for benefit to someone comes across as pretty weird. Because the first fruit of jealousy is typically a fairly violent attempt to stop what's going on. And that's the way the word's used in the New Testament. Twice, Jesus went into the temple with a whip of cords and drove those people out and turned their tables over and spilled their money and mixed it all among them, you know. And he did this because John says it was jealousy for the house of the Lord that moved him to this violent behavior. That's the typical reaction to jealousy. It's called zeal, but it's the same word, zealot. This is just an intensified form of it. But nonetheless, the whole thing is almost everybody recognizes that jealousy as a motive, you want to make them jealous? Why? Well, I think the why answer is in the downline reality. After the explosion of adrenaline has subsided, once the hot anger and hostility has had a day or two or three to wear off, because after that, this downline reality after the adrenaline crash often produces a kind of depression, sorrowful despair, a sense of loss, that the hostility and the hot anger and the action that was taken with it didn't really solve anything. It was fun while you were doing it, but afterwards it leaves you just with this hollow feeling like, you know, that explosion of jealousy really didn't change anything. I mean, for the good. And it's this tendency toward depression and sorrowful despair that raises the possibility of salvation, simply because in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, he said that the repentance that brings about salvation can be created by a godly sorrow, a sorrow that is in God's hands to bring about repentance. And that's why God says, I'm going to make you so angry and jealous, because once the initial fruit of that has worn off, then perhaps you'll just sink into this despair of sorrow. And then there's a possibility that you'll listen to reason. So it's possibly efficacious, but it's fraught with initial danger. Paul had experienced it as Saul of Tarsus. He had the hot hostility. He was glad Jesus of Nazareth had been crucified. And when Stephen, as a major spokesman in the streets of Jerusalem, began to challenge the leadership of Israel over their apostasy and rebellion, he was there holding the garments of those who stoned him to death, and he did it gladly. That was the hostility of jealousy. But it set him up on the road to Damascus. So Paul knew provoking them to jealousy was liable to getting killed. He knew that. But he also knew that there was a possibility that this would effectively bring about salvation for some. And that's an interesting thing because it's a sum of his fleshly kin. And according to Romans 9, verses 1 to 3, that was Paul's heartbeat. He never says he'd be willing to go to hell for the Gentiles. He put up with a lot of junk so they could get the message, but he never made that claim about the Gentiles. He did make it about the Jews. And according to verse 5 of this chapter, in the same way then, there has come to this present time a remnant, according to God's gracious choice. Paul's commitment was to the sum. That is the outcome of the efficacious working of provoking to jealousy and the after effects. Some will come to godly sorrow and repentance and salvation. And he basically taught that. That's the remnant doctrine. No, they won't work with the majority. The majority will rise up in rage and do everything they can to kill me. But there are some. And he even said in 2 Timothy, his last letter, chapter 2, verse 10, that he endured everything for the sake of God's elect. In other words, Paul had it firmly fixed in his mind that he was going to be preaching to gobs and gobs of people, and for the majority part, they would reject what he had to say. But that didn't unseat him. He said, look, there's always been a remnant. God's going to save some. I'm going to be the messenger for the some. And that's what I'm going to put up with, all the stuff I have to put up with, so that I can be the messenger to the some. So in a very real sense, he had stabilized his own soul in a figure by believing that God didn't send him to do vain work, that there would be some who would be saved as a consequence. So that's what he's doing in verse 13 and 14. I'm going to use this jealousy method, knowing full well it's going to cost me a great deal, but it will prove effective for the remnant according to God's gracious choice.